The people on Earth take a long time to decide how to say goodbye. They form committees, consider proposals, argue violently or with subtle skill, make deals, publish editorials, write learned papers. It is taking longer and longer for Earth and Moku to communicate. Finally, one day when it is almost too late, at a signal no one recalls initiating, they gather in cathedrals and squares and sing. They sing from flotillas of boats tethered together while they drink rum beneath fiery, poignant sunsets. They sing from observatories to the deep night sky, and as night flips swiftly to day in Bogota. They sing from self-driving vehicles. Old people stop their tennis games to sing. Children sing in schools. There are still schools, only much better ones. Tech advisors, stock manipulators, and people who still do not have clean water, but who do have a device, sing. They sing from bars, from the moon, and from every point in space where humans live. When the song arrives at the ship, as they are passing Neptune's orbit, they piece it together and gather, standing, and listen, looking back from whence they came, those tiny dots of life holding all they have ever known, seas, mountains, the three remaining tigers, the deep time and lucky chance that caused life, winds that flatten vast fields of wheat with great caressing hands, like the hands that once caressed them with such love and care. This is what they hear. Sleep, my child, and peace attend thee. All through the night, guardian angels God will send thee. All through the night, soft the drowsy hours are creeping, hill and vale in slumber steeping, I my loving vigil keeping, all through the night. The children and Pele hold hands and cry, knowing what they have lost. Pele knows that, for the children, it is the first step. It changes their brains. She does not know how she will get past it. Perhaps, she thinks later, alone and staring at the place she thought she always wanted to be, she never will. And now within the old gray tower we've climbed the winding stair, and look out over all the earth from topmost window there. Far stretches all the world away, and not shuts out the sky, as knights and maids and all of life go marching, marching by. Olive Beaupré Miller, from the Tower Window. Finally, as they pass out of the solar system, it is time. They must get moving. They must set forth. They must transform. And they do need her. They did bring her for a reason. She has lived this project, this drive, for decades, every detail of it. Bean's work has brought it to life, but there is no way to know how it will manifest, if they will survive, and, if they do, how it will change them. That part of it is greater than that which one can imagine. All is in readiness. She is awake. The fulcrum is here. She has the lever to move it. The minds, the dreams of the children are the weight. They offer her thoughts, ideas, visions, insights, like flowers, which she gathers, and they all spark together, pointing toward fruition, the shift that will carry life forward. This is humanity's main chance. She knows, but cannot think about, how important that is. She prepares to play a vast chord, the way her piano teacher taught her, knowing it all first, in the instant before her spread fingers descend to the cool, hard, certain keys, back straight, elbows wide, with all she is contained within that force. Pele plays. This is the chord that sounds. They are a creature of the deep sea, of interstellar space. They are a thought, and thought is matter. The ship, the matter, is like a film above, a fluid, a lens on the surface of their sky, the division between fluid and gas. They coalesce. They rise. Arrayed around Pele at that moment is a human orchestra, potential symphonies, jazz rhapsodies, new musics for which new brains to hear must be invented, On new planets, they may whirl and dance, skipping through the universe like stones, breaking through the surface tension of the strange fugue of time in which they are embedded, and sink back into life. "Oh," she says. "Oh." She bends over, weeping. First comes Bean, whose willowy arms surround but barely touch her. Then Ta'a'eva's rough embrace, her strong, gasping voice. Javale's tall blonde head bending down to touch hers. And then they are all in a huddle, embracing tightly, crying, swaying, and finally laughing as they break. "We will find the place we need," says Javale, his ever-adolescent voice breaking as he speaks, yet, as always, he sounds eminently reasonable. "As you can see, we have all the time in the world." "We may need more," observes Pele, her voice harsh, and they break into applause that sounds, to Pele, like surf sounding at Ka'ena Point. That is the last they see of her for a very long time. There is music and frolic in the special time of Fairyland. No yesterday and no tomorrow. Pipes call, trumpets sound. Nightingales, clear springs, the great rose trees, magic. Some good, some bad, but uncaring of humans, rather like space. Alcubierre eats Casimir vacuums for breakfast, rips them out of a field with her big yellow teeth and chomps on them. The edges of the vacuums stick out of the sides of her mouth like gold straw and tiny blue flowers and move up and down as she chomps and snorts. They are one speck of pollen on a single stamen of one small blue flower that bobs up and down in her mouth. The librarian carries a wooden clock. It is chiefly oak, framed by an oaken octagon a bit smaller than the main octagonal structure that holds the clock's mechanics and chimes. The face is protected by a glass door 10 inches in diameter that one can open with a small latch. The hours are Roman numerals painted on a cream-colored metal face, in black, swirling copperplate, a single word, Excelsior. It has a smaller glass door below that one can open to start the pendulum swinging. The librarian carries it cradled in her left arm like a baby. Therefore, it does not tick, for the pendulum drops against the back of its compartment. The hands of the clock are silver. They're deliciously narrow, elongated arrows, a final flourish, pointing at the hour, the minute, and the infinite in-betweens. A key rattles inside its small, latched drawer at the bottom of the pendulum when she walks, and the three square holes in the face's clock emit faint light. Sometimes she unlatches the drawer, opens it, and examines the key closely with a look of wonder on her face. Then she returns it to its drawer and relatches the tiny brass hook. Every so often, she opens the door of the clock's face, tilts her head, smiles, and moves first the long arrow to a place that seems random, and then the small hand. She beams at the clock, shuts the door, and goes about her business. She never inserts the key. She never winds the clock. If she has to do something requiring the use of her left hand, she sets the clock carefully in a safe place and immediately retrieves it when done. She straps it in beside her when she sleeps. This seems a burdensome practice, but it gives her pleasure. Laying bets regarding various aspects of what she does with the clock have become popular. It gives us something to do. In one of the vacuums, there are many, I grew this voice that says, "We." I don't know how, though I am trying to tell you. I might have grown it when I was Nancy Drew, in her blue roadster, driving through dark space past planets. 1, 2, 3, 10,000. It took a long time. Then there were white farmhouses just off a dusty dirt road, hidden behind summer trees, their big heads tossing in the hot wind as if they had something haughty to say. Inside one house with open windows, a planet mobile rotated in the breeze. a girl with long black braids, lying on a double wedding ring quilt made by her grandmother, pointed to them and said, "Strike Hypatia off the list, and Dulcinea, too." They disappeared from the mobile, and others appeared. I sped into the brain of the little girl, and it was all myth, science, clockwork, precise, wires, pulses, blood, AI, luminous, expanding, nova, pressure, Big Bang, dust, and me, driving past on Country Lane in a blue roadster, hair streaming violently far, far, far out behind me, pushed by my own speed, seeing white snowball bushes in the front yard and a cherry tree and a woman gathering billowing white sheets from a clothesline and a girl inside analyzing planetary composition. You can see why I can't tell you exactly how it happened. Pele looks like Pele, except that her eyes are different. She won't look at anyone. She does smile a lot. She calls herself the librarian and says she would like to help us. This is when the clock shows up. You know about that already. We can't really blame her for acting this way. She had many areas of expertise when we stole the Moku, like all the other adults on the ship. But she was uniquely special, so we stole her, too. She knew how to make our horse. She thinks that she chose to help us by staying with us and saved all the other adults by sending them back to Earth. She thinks she is our savior. We let her think that, because whenever she realizes that we have control, she acts in ways that are not helpful to us. For instance, when the prince arrives to kiss her, and is the prince us and what we did? It seems possible. She pushes him down, kicks him in the side 3 times. Once or twice is not enough, while 4 or more is overdoing it. And strides off, down a long, winding road, over hill and dale, hands in her pockets, whistling, looking at everything with a keen and watchful eye. She walks through rain, hail, sleet, and snow, singing about it, all bundled up, sometimes an old woman, sometimes a young maiden, and then through summer meadows that climb the flanks of mountains, her clock in a bag that she throws over her shoulder. She wears loose purple linen pants with large pockets, which she fills with things that seem useless. She sees beautiful glowing stones by the side of the path, one gray, one gold, and one rainbowed with layers of minerals. She picks them up and examines each, a large smile on her face. She puts them in her right-hand pants pocket. To us, they look like dull old rocks, but then, somehow, like magic. We see them through her eyes and know what they are. The stones and the power of stones are stories. She is gathering all the stories everyone has ever told, and our stories, and keeping them safe in her pocket until we know how to tell them. There are so many stories in that pocket that you would think her pants would fall down, but though the stories are endless and the stones are all different, they do not. For the stones are magic stones, the pants, magic pants. Only if we sit around a fire that lights our faces and dances to the dark treetops whenever one of us throws on branches scavenged from the woods, throwing sparks into the night, does she consent to pull out a stone and tell us a story. We have to beg and yell at her. She says that only then are our brains receptive, when we are parched of stories. She says this is a way to go back to the beginning, to break down our brains to a place we had bypassed in our speed to understand. And that was during the time that we were supposed to look at other faces and wonder what they were thinking. We were supposed to learn to understand when they were sad, when they were happy, and when they had feelings that were more complex, like a flavor or scent or a sound that comes out of the deep, dank forest that is a sweet, mysterious music that calls you to come. She says this is the beginning of love. When she talks like that, when she tells us stories, her voice is rich and deep, her face fluid, when often it is flat, like some of ours. Her stories change our brains. We can even measure where and how much. It's something to do. Her eyes get very wide or narrow to slits. Her mouth assumes strange shapes. Sometimes she opens it wide and screams, reaches to the sky and grabs at it, her hands open, then grasps as she suddenly, in an instant, catches something and pulls it to her chest and bows her head over it, and her long white hair veils her mysterious face, pale in the moonlight, silent as one of her stones. And we cry without knowing why, feeling helpless and at the same time knowing that she will help. It is the age of stories. We suck them down like nectar. We search for our new home. We move like a sea creature through the dark, generating our own electricity, fluid, ever-changing, ship translucent or solid-seeming, as we wish. We grow no older. Why? Biological processes continue, of course. We live. We do the things we need to do. But our horse is wise and knows much more than we. Pele is still there, though they don't know it, or they do, sometimes. She fears a foray through some other kind of space-time weather, in which they will all age to telomerase endgame and die in what seems minutes. Who knows? The instant that divides life and death, we must learn to skip it. Periods of waking like cards constantly shuffled, the deck and game continually changing, the rules, the faces, the very basis of the numbers and what they mean. "This one is too cold," says Isho, who is Goldilocks. "And this one is too hot."
"And none is just right, and none will ever be," screams Ta'a'eva, who is always the biggest bear. She storms away from the cottage. Isho and Kevin, the middle-sized bear, drop into tiny green chairs, sobbing.
"That's not how it goes," says Alouetta, kneeling and holding Isho and Kevin in a skinny-armed embrace. "You know the story, happy ending and all that."
"No," says Kevin, his voice wild. "No, none of them are right. None of them ever will be right. There is no place for us in any universe except Earth, and it is gone."
He flings himself at Pele and tries to hit her in a flurry of punches.
"My mother is gone. My father is gone. My sisters and brothers are gone. All these stories are lies."
Pele holds him back for a moment, and just at the right time, she lets him collapse against her. She grabs him, holds him, rocks him back and forth. "I know, Kevin. Except this is not the end of the story. It's not the end at all." Kevin fights free and runs. Pele drops to the tiny stairs of the cottage and drops her head to her hands. It no longer matters whether she did the right thing or the wrong thing. Those words have no meaning. Here they are. Ta'a'eva returns from wherever she went and stands next to Pele.
"Sit up straight."
Pele feels the girl's sure fingers dance against her scalp, hears the swift thush, thush of braiding.
"We are wayfaring. We need to watch the sky, the birds, the waves. Kevin," she shouts, "check out the signature of the star we found yesterday."
Kevin's sullen voice, muffled by tears, issues from the forest.
"There is no signature. There is no star."
A rock bounces off the side of the cottage.
"Liar."
Pele hears Ta'a'eva's low chuckle.
"Yesterday, we grew new eyes. I just found out. Go and see. It's true."
Kevin hurries away. Shea, the big organdy bow on her dress untied and trailing behind her, says,
"Pele, none of us believe in these stories, you know. They're all a bunch of hooey, an artificial organization that gathers reality together like a bouquet of flowers, just picking the prettiest ones and ignoring everything that has turned brown already. And that organized bouquet still dies the next day and gets thrown in the trash. We pretend to make you happy."
"That's quite wonderful of you," Pele says. "I appreciate it." She does not point out that in another of their flashes, their realities, their lives, whatever you might call it, when they wake and wake again, resume their lives like nodes of blinking light in the depths of the deepest sea,
None of them would have even understood that Pele could be happy or sad, and if they had, it would not have mattered to them. Her clock is on the wall of the tiny bedroom upstairs. We wonder if she knows it. Kevin is right. We might have missed the news. It might have failed to penetrate to where we were. It would have been better if we had never known. Instead, it is a scream of deepest sorrow that runs through the ship, penetrates to our very core. We are now, evermore, and henceforth, alone. The Earth and all its life is gone. There was a nuclear war. All their painstaking and careful safeguards could not hold against a handful of people who did not care for life. Unknowable flashes, garbled pictures, sick-making nightmares, and mornings of waking in our own beds as the sweet birds sing. There is no way to measure that time. We wonder if the librarian's clock has anything to do with this, but she will not say. Ta'a'eva keeps telling Pele that she had no choice, that they had sussed her out from the beginning. Pele knows that isn't true. They had no idea why she did it. They didn't know because neither did she. It is a big, fat, tragic mystery. She makes that mystery into a vase that she keeps on her kitchen window. She fills the vase with starlight as the memory threads holding her to Earth stretch and finally snap, leaving her weightless. She needs weight to live. We read the stars, their signatures and histories, and calculate the planets that may have spawned. There are gas giants, dead rocks too cold or too dark for what we might call life, and some don't spin, but some of them have water, and it is toward them that we navigate until we are close enough for searing disappointment. During our navigation, we turn into ourselves again. We remember that our personalities are formed by the languages of genes, not stories, but that our actions can be influenced by the stories we learn. It's actually very scary. When we are lucky enough to grow up with stories of love and not meanness and hate, then we can love. Love makes us happy. Stories of hate teach us only how to be victorious and to hurt others. What is most scary is how many ways we can hurt each other without even knowing that we have, or how hard it is to learn to act in ways that do not hurt others the next time. That is because there is never a same next time, so something has to be constant and at the same time fluid inside of you in the place that acts. Sometimes it is easy to think that there isn't anything anyone can do about this. Sometimes sadness teaches lessons that lead to more sadness, but sometimes it can lead to changed behavior. Sometimes happiness cannot figure out how to give itself to others. Sometimes joy can only be lived. A lucky chance that one takes, a risk that says, damn the consequences. But sometimes the consequences can lead to all kinds of bad places. One must keep air inside a bladder and shoot back to the sun. Not everyone knows how to do this. Not everyone has a bladder, air, a sea, or a sun. We are lucky. We wake from another cold sleep. Sometimes we are in cocoons, other times in coffins, and kissed to consciousness by the prince of all good dreams. Sometimes we pass the time as equations or as prime numbers, one unique majestic mountain peak after another. That's infinity. That's real fun. And, of course, it takes a very long time, or so it seems. We incorporate ourselves and grow ourselves and enhance ourselves with the genes of other species. We invent new species, we discard them, and sometimes they discard us. Then we bloom again, but different somewhat. Still, we keep the memory of life, rich life, towards which we long with all our hearts, and the palette of a planet which we will change, which will change us. Life. We fire the forest, stand back from the searing heat, retreat behind a clear panel, and watch the blaze. Though they live longer than anything else, bristlecone pines eventually need fire for regenesis. On Earth, lightning performed that function. Yes, it has been that long, and longer.
Alcubierre has no colors, or more colors than we can know. She is immense, invisible.
Some of us grow new senses that we use to pat Alcubierre on her withers, even though it looks as if we are making the bed, or splitting firewood, or watching ants have wars. These are things no one has to do any longer, but some of us think it is helpful to believe they are doing them, so we make work for ourselves and say it keeps us sane.
Alcubierre is so huge that we will never see the beginning or end of her. In fact, the only way to think about her is with other kinds of symbols, not words. That accounts for how the story keeps changing who we are and how we tell it.
We look at Pele's vase.
"What is that?"
asks Shia. Pele says, "It is sadness too strong to bear, but it is something I need to feel. If we cannot understand how our actions impact others, we will bring nothing to the place we are going."
Kevin frowns.
"That makes no sense at all."
"It does to me."
The librarian has been in the library for a very, very long time, through two cold sleeps at least. Now she sits, smiling at the clock. Amelia, who has been lying on her back, thinking, jumps up, smiling.
"I have an idea."
She gently lifts the clock from the librarian's hands. The librarian stands stiffly. She moves her arms forward a few inches, but no farther. She stares at the clock, her mouth slightly open, distress in her eyes. Amelia opens the little door holding the rattling key, and then the door to the face that contains the keyholes.
"That won't work," says Ta'a'eva.
"We must keep trying," says Amelia. She whines, whines, whines each mechanism.
"Hold this,"
she says, handing the key to Jacques. She opens the door for the pendulum and sets it ticking. Then she takes the clock and presses it to the wall. It adheres, becoming a part of the ship, and something of the ship flows into it. The librarian gasps.
"No!"
She runs to the clock and tries to wrestle it from the wall. As she yanks on it, she wails,
"No, no, no!"
But she does not allow Amelia to gently move her aside.
"Look!" says Amelia.
The librarian has changed to Pele. Pele of the mobile face. The warm, beautiful brown eyes.
"Thank you," she says.
Sometimes Pele prepares for the invasion. Invisibly, in particles, they scout the terrain of Terra Nova, Planet X. It breaks down in this way. 1. It is empty, ready for us, with no life, but able to accept life, or with life that will not interfere with ours, or 2. They are ready for us, or something like us. The branches. 1. Annihilation. 2. Rejection. 3. Acceptance / modification. 4. Surrender. Of these 4, Pele fancies most number 3, except what are they save identity? Yet, identity undergoes constant modification. This is a special kind of hell. She decides to enjoy 1,000 amazing sunsets to refresh herself. Pele wonders how to say what is happening. Time passes? Space-time moves? We flash and flash again, in long instants, out of darkness and into light. They play and play again, in endless iterations. The running of the ship, the thought ship? Inflections wash through it each moment, earth-based inflections of thought wrought from the hard thrash of human dreams, human longing. So, they are all dancing ship stories. That's all they are, stories. Pele's unique slice of older time gives her wry perspective. She can be outside the story. She stubbornly refuses to surrender. It is not real, she thinks, seeing them all at play, leaping from bloody mayhem to the estranging magic of through fairy halls, and often lying spent and weeping on a riverbank after being swept up in the billions of dark stories that comprise their heritage. It takes all her strength and more, drawn from a rich stew of inspiring works, to pull them back from self-annihilation. For what choice is there, they collectively feel, after being soaked in the deep evil that humans do, but to remove themselves from the picture? Whether or not they are right, she hurls tales of goodness, blazing thunderbolts into their minds. They wake bright-faced, with a jolt, ready for the new day. She doesn't exactly dust her hands in self-satisfaction, but she does try not to wonder too hard if she's done the right thing. Who is she to shield them from grief, from sorrow, from deep reflection, or from growth? She just tries to keep them from hurting one another, and from hurting them or herself. What else can she do? She tries to be older and wiser. She absorbs old movies, reviews Casablanca as a lesson about how one bestows grace through artful lies concocted on the run, new tales to make things go right. These are lessons she missed while on Earth. She spoke from stalwart truth, never mind what pain it caused. How can one make these calculations, though, when in the midst of chaos, which is where she lives, in a constantly reinvented throng of young entities who cannot understand literatures truly until they have gained in wisdom? And who cannot gain wisdom except through sorrow, which she does not wish to thrust upon them? Sorrow generally bestows cynicism, and she is back in the same old revolution, lifted up and down until they die, except they cannot die. We are scattered into particles. We are a speeding cloud, intent. It is a word at last, the word that's been there all along, our Kansas home, courage, with a Brooklyn accent. Whatever, wherever that is. Courage, we shout. Our brave chests expand, our heads a single thought. Shooting, for we know not what, reorganized by new information every instant, but shooting forward now, at last, to planet. We will find ways to infuse any matter we find. We will organize and blend. We will crush and release. For we are the mighty, the awful, the terrifying power of life itself. We are infinitely tiny, infinitely large. Our words describe the states that we create, the states create us, and a bond sings through it all. Courage. We crash onto every wave-hushed shore, every cold, rocky outpost, every object that will hold us with equal, eager, organizing force, programs of life and flower, for a brief instant of stability, everywhere at once, a wide delight of life itself. We pass the instant of death, the deep drag of dread and sadness, the roiling, drowning crush of force upon force. We rush up the beaches, we drift to the high peaks, we burrow, nest, burst, and sing, and leave ourselves, that dream of us, behind, and continue. An instant from far here to far there, like the instant dividing life from death, but skipping that, as it must be skipped. This is the story of how a bunch of kids kidnapped a physicist who was also a librarian so that they could get to a new planet, one far outside of our solar system. It sounds like a fairy tale, because it might be. It is really very simple. We cross a roaring creek on a rickety bridge, fishing pole on our shoulder, in a deep mountain chasm, heading home in an evening of cold, settling mist, alone, yet heading somewhere. A tentative confidence sparkles, a stand of tiny pink galax that Pele does not pick. She hikes upward through an early spring forest of reawakened earth, its moist smell of leaf loam and the rush of the newborn creek fed by high snow melt, a cool, moist blessing, as is the fact of day, where trees hide most of the sky and those tempting empty stars. She comes across it again and again in her solitary hikes, and each time kneels and contemplates it with renewed, deep, solitary wonder, it and her. A different life, with a different story, but a story nonetheless. Life, in all that lifelessness. After 1,000 such flash lives, filled with wonder, bursting into time, she returns to here, knows it to be real, and for the first time, Pele does not recoil. Why did she do it? Why did she let them go? Was it hubris, wanting to see if her science project would really work? Was it a heroic act, a Noah for the Ark? Blind, rushing ignorance? This is our house. This is our bed. These are our chairs.
"We have left Oz in a magic balloon," says Tarka, lying on his back with his hands laced behind his neck. "We made the fire, like the professor. So, who is the Wicked Witch of the West who will punish us for trying to get to our new home?"
"Pele!" yells Oscar.
"No," several chorus. Key says, "Pele is Glinda."
"Pele is the sleeping princess."
"She's awake."
"Not really."
"And so, are we all munchkins?" asks Juno indignantly. "Or flying monkeys?"
"I'm a flying monkey,"
says Targa, flipping over and pushing off, soaring with arms extended. "And do we have hearts?"
"I am working on mine," says Bean, splaying two long-fingered hands across her chest. "I am working very, very hard." Pele, hunched near fetal in her birth, hears voices. She always does, but these wake her for some reason. She opens one eye and sees that they have furnished her with a crystal ball with which to watch the proceedings. She allows herself a brief, tiny smile, uncurls, stretches, and leans forward on her elbows. "Wicked Witch," she votes aloud, her long, unused vocal cords pushing it out as a rusty whisper. They all look at the monitor, wave, and cheer.
"Pele, Pele, Pele."
She tests the most important word.
"Courage."
"Courage,"
they yell back.
"Courage!"
How long can longing last? Is English really so sparse? Pele finds the German word Sehnsucht. Sounds like a sneeze. And that C.S. Lewis said it is that unnameable something, desire, for which pierces us like a rapier at the smell of bonfire, the sound of wild ducks flying overhead, the title of The Well at the World's End, the opening lines of Kubla Khan, the morning cobwebs in late summer, or the noise of falling waves carrying the freight of longing's complexity modified by underlying stratum of utopias particular to each individual. But English has its strengths, for longing indeed is long, endless, in fact, until what she imagines will be that eye blink, sudden as their previous transition to the inescapable longing of perpetual now. Presently, that is Pele's name for this planet.
Sehnsucht.
Sehnsucht,
Pele says, and saying it changes her brain. Or something, maybe.
Despite all we know and all we have learned about Shining Leaf, as Ta'a'a'eva insists we call this planet, there is much that remains unknown. Shining Leaf is just a blip, another flash, a nanosecond opening that, taking, we risk all. We have seeded other planets with our clones. As far as we know, they all died. We all died. But here we are. Still, we are, at last, restless. In fact, we are able to realize that we are mad, that we are ready to choose. Pele never votes. I voted once, she says, and we say, yes, and we are glad that you did. She makes us promise something, and, at last, we do. We cannot even talk about the painful changes that swept through us when we disengaged the drive, how it looked, felt, the precise analytics, biological and physical, how long it took in mundane time, the unspinning, realizing the door of us, each unique. Moku could tell that story, and those in the future will want to know. Having lived it is enough for us. Moku was our home. It sustained us in our search, kept us alive, taught us much, but kept us in a state of fear and hesitation. We wanted to grow up badly enough to die if it did not work. Like Pinocchio, we wanted to be real. We saw our main chance, and we took it, and so became human again. How can you tell the choice between good and evil when that choice is hard upon you? How do you recognize it? Is there a way to measure the road not taken? Why would that matter? We have learned much about taking risk. We could not help moving into this. From the giant's abode in the sky, Jack stole the harp that plays by itself. The ship is that. We stole it. From the giant's abode in the sky, Jack stole the goose that lays the golden egg. Perhaps that is us. Will we live happily ever after? Time will tell. When a horse wins a race, she is heaped with flowers. She snorts and prances and feels proud. Our horse, on which we placed all bets, won. So many suns, so many planets that did not suit, you know that tale. Some, seated by us with life, might now be flourishing. But we will never know. It is not luck that brought us here to this perfect planet with its perfect star. It was courage. Beneath this glorious, intense blue-violet sky buffeted by sea wind, I know, ineluctably, that I am here, on this loud coast. Crashing waves suck rattling, tumbling stones back into the shorebreak, nicking my bare feet and calves with delicious, sharp pings. Sunset-tinged clouds billow like great swans on the horizon. I pull in breaths of sweet, salt air, keeping an eye on my great-granddaughter, playing tag with rushing foam. Shining Leaf is no game, no illusion, no manufactured reality, and it is no fairy tale. I spin round and see the gully-ridden cliff behind me rise, thick with massive virgin trees, relatives of red alder, big leaf maple, Sitka spruce, trees that relish deep morning fog. They ascend in tiers of wind-tossed greens to the long grasslands above. The pampas stretch for 50 miles to snow-peaked mountains, where just below the treeline, buffeting winds twist and gnarl the bristlecone pines. Across the plains gallop herds of savanna animals, for our biosystems found homes here as well and have flourished. And when I ride my real horse there, she actually moves, and we do reach the plane trees. Sometimes, after opening my bedroll and making tea, a human speck amid a sea of high, sweet-smelling grasses, where the sound of the rushing wind combing and flattening the grass is equally sweet, I gaze at the stars, among which I lived for I do not know how long, and am infused suddenly by a sense of deep and utter strangeness, illuminated by that flash we all felt, or were, on Moku. It seems just a second, but I cannot be sure how long it lasts, that flash during which I am transformed, illuminated. It could be eons. It could be Planck time, the tiniest bit of time we can measure. But when I am there, and perhaps always, I am like a pebble of pure consciousness tossed into the most lucid medium imaginable, where my ripples intersect with and are changed by other patterns, and this goes on forever. And it is then that I know that I am not as I was, and it is then that I long to be back among the stars and to never touch land again. But here, I invent new languages to map the house of thought I build. My thoughts were useful once. They may be useful again. Or not.
I could tell you how our chimerists, biophysicists, engineers, artists, and mathematicians generated experimental interim environments to test and refine our interaction with this new planet as we explored it virtually, hungering to land and climb its towering young mountains and sail its vast seas. We studied its weather patterns, developed plans for symbiosis, testing and retesting, accelerating path after path, answering question after question, for we had time, and we had to be satisfied. But that is all in our library. You can experience it there. We grew, changed, exploded into larger life, real life, using Moku's vast genetic library and modeling algorithms to make decisions about populating Shining Leaf with ourselves and other fauna, learning from stories of failures on Earth, merging with what was here. The very last step, the most serious, was deciding where best to settle and how. We chose well. We changed very slightly to adapt to Shining Leaf, to its particular chemistries, its atmosphere, and its wilder seas, which Ta'a'eva's tribe explores with zest, though Moku mapped its every fractal coast, her motto being, "The map is not the territory." We grew defenses against that which would have killed us, larger and different lungs to inhale and use a slightly different atmosphere. Akupira gave us time to do that. We live in towns and villages scattered around the planet and have plans for golden cities, both far and near, which now assemble. We have new sciences, new technologies, communications networks that run on new symbioses, and the sure knowledge that we are still changing, because life is change, and because change is life. I have young Bean's heart and mind, yet my grown mind is different, a human/space-time hybrid, and my hard-grown soul my own. Is a soul courage? Is it philosophical depth? Is it simple immortality? Is it the being that runs through us, animates us, the foundation of all love and hope and deep satisfaction in the art of living, in community, in life itself? Here, we and our children chart their own courses. They are pioneers, seekers, builders, dreamers. One son is an artist, one daughter an engineer. My many descendants flourish. The wind, evening strong, blows back my hair. I lean down and pluck up a cool, gleaming golden stone from the tumble, hold its weather-honed, near-translucent thinness up to our new star, and think of all the time this one stone holds and might reveal, from when it exploded into being until now. After being crushed and washed and tumbled and honed into this beauty that I, also a part of the same story, can see, hold, taste, and smell. I give it to my great-granddaughter, who is 4, to play with, and she flips it in the air and laughs. Her eyes are hazel, like my father's. I think of the librarian who died long, long ago, and know for a certainty, which has not always been the case, that she was real, and that this is not a fairy tale, but something we have done. We named our star for her, Pele. She helped me grow a soul, and that makes everything worth it. Here's a high and a ho for the purpose strong, and the bold, stout hearts that roam, and sail the 7 seas of life to bring such treasures home. Olive Beaupré Miller, The Treasure Chest. With everlasting thanks to Irma Gwendolyn Knott. Poems Herein by Olive Beaupré Miller. My Bookhouse. The Bookhouse for Children Publishers. Chicago, Illinois, 1920.